I don't know, 20 years or so. I don't really know the answer. I don't really know the exact amount of time, but students from Woodland Oaks have attended Camp Wildwood in Searcy, Arkansas every summer, and about a week ago we came back from another session of that, and this was my third year to get to go up and actually spend a few days there, and I've enjoyed getting to make some new friends while there, and it's neat to be able to stand up here this morning and look, and some of those friends are here this morning, some of these college students who have come back from taking a break before school starts. So if you're visiting with us, we're glad to have you here this morning. One of my most favorite movies of all time is the movie City Slickers. The story of three middle-aged men who go out to New Mexico, Colorado, and that area, and join up on a cattle drive in order to find themselves. And one of the main characters in the movie is Curly, played by the actor Jack Palance. Curly was the ultimate man. He was a cowboy, rough, tough, intimidating, ate bacon at every meal. Many of the things that probably most men would dream of being able to live like. And at one part of the movie, Mitch, played by Billy Crystal, and Curly, Jack Palance, are discussing whether or not Curly had ever been in love. And Curly goes on to tell him a story that he said, "Yeah, I was once." He said, "I was driving a herd across the panhandle of Texas, and late in the day, I came up on the top of a hill, and off in the distance, I saw a woman on her knees working in the dirt. And she stood up to stretch her back, and she said, against the setting sun, seeing her silhouette against the setting sun, he said, I just knew then I was in love." And Mitch goes on to ask him, he says, "Well, hey, what happened? Did you marry her? What happened?" He said, "No. I turned around and I rode away." And he says, "Well, why did you do that? You could have been happy forever." He said, "Well, I figured it just wasn't going to get any better than that." You know, it's a standard stereotype that men do not know how to show love. And I guess we could say that for many, it may be an accurate description. But life has a way of showing us that it's not just an accurate description for men alone. There are even some women who we meet in our lives who have a difficult time showing and expressing love to the people around them. And the reasons why we have such a hard time expressing love, the reasons vary. For some people, maybe they don't know how to show love. They were never shown love themselves in their formative years as children. And so as they grow up, it's no surprise that coming into adulthood, they have a hard time themselves knowing how to express that love, which in and of itself is a huge lesson for parents. We must be showing our children love every single day of their existence, not just for their own sake of knowing that they are loved, but for the sake of their children and their grandchildren. Because it can become a vicious cycle when one set of parents refuses to show love to their children. But for some people, it's not just simply that, okay, I don't know how to show love, but maybe I don't want to show you love. At some point, and for some of us, at some point in our life, we've had someone that we deeply cared about, whether it be a family member or a close friend, only to have something happen in which they broke our heart. They disappointed us to the point that it changed the course of our life. And maybe some years later, that person returns to us and says, I'd like to make amends for this. I would like to be the recipient of your love. But the person that they've hurt says, I don't want to love you. I don't want to have that kind of relationship with you. Or maybe very closely tied to it is that for some people to show love makes them feel very vulnerable. In a dog-eat-dog world, many people have learned to survive. And the way that they survive is by keeping a rather stoic or a stone-faced appearance. They've encased their heart in a hard shell. And in order, and if they were to express love or show love to someone else, they would have to crack that outer shell of from their heart, and they would have to show what maybe they perceive as weakness. And if the people around them perceive weakness, then maybe I won't be as successful because somebody might take advantage of that weakness. And so because they feel vulnerable, some people don't show love. And yet there are some who have tried to make themselves feel better by saying, well, you know, just because I don't show it doesn't mean that I don't feel it. But what good does that honestly do? To feel it but not show it? How many stories have we heard of the mom or dad on their deathbed with their children gathered around, calloused and cold from the years of strained relationships with their parents? And in the final fleeting moments of their lives, the parents look up and they say, I didn't tell you this near enough, but I love you and I'm proud of you. Now, while it may make the parent feel better, what good has it really done for that child? At this point in the game, probably not too much good. And that's why we must understand Paul's words from 1 Corinthians 13, 1 through 3, as we had read earlier. When he really tries to hammer home to us, it doesn't matter what you have accomplished. It doesn't even matter what you have the ability to accomplish. If love is not the motivating factor behind everything that we do, it profits me nothing. It is of no value. As followers of God, we are expected to express godly love to everyone. In Mark chapter 12, verses 30 and 31, we find the greatest commandment. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. In Luke chapter 6, verses 32 and 36, which we had read a moment ago, Jesus poses a pretty simple question. If you only love those who love you in return, so what? The pagans and sinners who don't even believe in God can do that. And then in 1 John chapter 3, verses 10 and 11, we find this simple admonition and statement that if we are children of God, we love one another. But how is godly love expressed? How can I know if my actions are godly or selfish? What if I'm one of those who's never been taught how to love? Or maybe I have shut that emotion out of my life for so long that I'm not sure I remember how to express love to somebody. Or maybe I just want to increase my faith by showing a greater measure of God's love to the people around me. How do I know that my actions are demonstrating the love that I feel? And the answer to that lies within what we have dubbed the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. And this morning we're going to begin a two-part lesson. We'll finish it up tonight. And for those of you who have been coming to the Wednesday night summer series, I hope that our discussion today will help maybe bring some of these characteristics of godly love and tie them together for you. If you've not been able to come to the Wednesday night series, we've got a few left, and I hope that maybe our discussion will stir up a little desire for you to come and hear some greater discussion of some of these characteristics specifically. But what we're going to find is that in 1 Corinthians 13, Paul builds a sort of pyramid of godly love. And each step of this pyramid is built upon the previous one. And if you are looking at your life trying to figure out, am I expressing godly love? Look to these characteristics. If these are exemplified in your actions, it's a good gauge to see that you are expressing the love that God wants us to express. But like every structure, we have to begin with a foundation. Paul begins with two very positive virtues. He says, love is patient, love is kind. And these two are the base of godly love. They are directly linked together. And if these two qualities disappear from your life, godly love disappears from your life. Patience literally means to be long of spirit. It's kind of like a rubber band being stretched. You have to stretch it a relatively long way before it snaps. Our patience is like a rubber band. The more patience we have, the farther we can be stretched before we snap. But directly linked to that is kindness. Kindness means to show oneself mild. It is the direct product of our patience. Think about a time when someone was patient with you. Maybe it was a teacher or a coach or maybe a fellow employee, an employer, a family member. How did you know that they were being patient with you in the midst of all your mistakes? You knew it because they suppressed their frustration in order to be polite and mild. How do you know when someone's patience has run out? They are no longer suppressing those frustrations. The kindness disappears. Thus, they are directly linked. And so as we go through our discussion today and tonight, keep in mind, these two characteristics are at the very heart and soul. They are the base of godly love. And in order for us to show that love, these two must be present in our lives. But Paul goes on, and what we're going to spend our time on for the rest of our time this morning, Paul goes through a series of, if you will, negative characteristics of godly love. Things that love is not, or that love does not do. And especially in these characteristics, we find a chain reaction. If you allow one of these negative characteristics to come into your life, and it goes unchecked, you will find yourself gradually falling farther and farther away from that expression of love. And the first thing that Paul shows us, he says that love does not envy. Literally, it means to be heated or to boil with jealousy. Envy occurs in our lives when someone else succeeds above us. We're sitting around and we're sharing the stories and we hear of someone's great success. Something wonderful happened in their life and we don't understand why. Maybe it's because they are getting the attention that I want. But something begins to churn inside of me. Something begins to boil up and all of a sudden we find that there's a tinge of jealousy that wasn't there before. Solomon warned that this emotion, saying in Proverbs 14:30, a tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. And envy has been the cause of many a crime throughout history. Even Pilate realized that Jesus had been delivered up for crucifixion because the chief priests envied him. And if we allow ourselves to become envious of someone else, Paul notes that our next reaction is to boast. The dictionary, I love this, gives a very formal definition of boasting. A self-display employing rhetorical embellishments in extolling oneself excessively. What do we do when someone else is relating their success story? Many of us begin to talk big about ourselves, relating some other story, some accomplishment, some experience of our own, because we will not be outdone. I cannot let your success be greater than mine. You see, so many of us have this overwhelming urge to outshine everyone else. And we begin to tell our own story, oftentimes embellishing on the details in order to make our own experience or accomplishment seem that much greater than theirs. And such boasting forgets Solomon's wise words. Let another one praise you and not your own mouth. Let a stranger and not your own lips. Proverbs 27:2. But once boasting comes in, Paul continues with his thought. Love does not boast, but love is also not arrogant. To be arrogant means to inflate, to blow up, or to cause to swell. Very much like a balloon. The more hot air you blow into it, the bigger it gets. The more we boast about our own accomplishments, the bigger the perception of ourselves. And truth be told, the vast majority of the time, that perception is greatly skewed within our own mind. Because we are continually filling our own ego with hot air. And it's usually about this point that a certain amount of dislike might be felt by those around us. You see, most people can overlook the occasional boasting and swapping of stories. I mean, you know, reality is that for some people, it can be kind of entertaining from time to time, swapping these stories. But arrogance is the result of continuous boasting. When a person refuses to stop long enough to let their ego deflate just a bit. And that arrogance is fueled by the failure of the boaster to let the conversation end. Instead, he continually plays it over and over in his head, perhaps making his own story that much grander. And as a person becomes more arrogant, his actions are no longer those of love, but of disrespect. Thus, Paul goes on to show us or remind us that love is not rude, meaning to act unbecomingly. Rudeness is the inevitable result of unchecked arrogance. I'm better than you, and I'm going to let you know it. And we communicate such a message in a vast array of methods. It may be condescending looks, snide remarks, a cheapening of someone else's point of view. And the thing is that if we have allowed ourselves to get to this point in our relationships with others, this point of rudeness, we have very possibly put ourselves in a vicious cycle. Because the rudeness we demonstrate leads to more boasting, which leads to greater arrogance, which leads to more intense rudeness, and so on and so on. And if it goes unchecked, we find out Paul's next point, that love does not insist on its own way. Other versions may say love does not seek itself or seek its own way. You know, it's only natural that if I have bragged about myself and I have become arrogant about my abilities, then obviously it's my way or the highway. We have no regard for the ideas or pursuits of others because we are so blinded by our own interests. This particular negative characteristic has been the cause for many a hostile meeting among God's children. Congregations have split and friendships have been severed because one person or a group of people insisted on their own way without considering the ideas and interests of others. And all of a sudden we find and we witness Proverbs 12:15 in real life. The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. And then one day someone tries to reason with us, tries to get us to listen to someone else for just a bit, only to find that we are, as Paul phrases it, irritable or provoked. Literally, it means to make sharp. When things stop going my way, then I become sharp with others. Do not cross my path or I'm going to bite your head off. In many cases, it's an intimidation tactic that will often work for the person who is using it, but at a very, very high price. The one who uses intimidation to get what they want will ultimately find themselves with little more than a few acquaintances and no intimate relationships to speak of. In all likelihood, if he were to count them up, he probably has more enemies than he does friends. Which leads us to find out that love is not resentful. Love does not take account or keep a record of evil. In 1973, in the wake of the Watergate scandal, the Senate Watergate Committee released two lists that had been comprised by members of the Nixon administration, ultimately recording over 200 names, ranging from politicians to celebrities to members of the media to businessmen. The list became known as Nixon's Enemies List. And in light of our discussion this morning, it's important for us to realize that we can put ourselves on a very similar and dangerous slope if we become resentful of those who differ from us by creating our own enemies list. We may find ourselves saying, if you cross me, then you're on my blacklist. And once someone is on our list, it's probably very difficult for them to get off of it. Because now this relationship is not about expressing God's love, but it's about maintaining the status quo between us. There's very little room for grace and mercy because it's filled with strife and tension. In fact, such an account of evil, such an enemies list, results in Paul's reminder that love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. And this is not the perspective of rejoicing in the fact that I am doing wrong, but rather that the wrongdoing is happening to others. This is the day in high school when the annoying classmate gets busted for cheating or she breaks up with her longtime boyfriend. Or maybe this is the coworker, that obnoxious coworker who gets called in and is reprimanded by the boss because they didn't do the job quite well enough. And as the events are unfolding before our eyes, deep inside of us, there's that little voice that's jumping up and down going, yes, my enemies are suffering. Great. And it's at times like this that the voice of God cries out, do not gloat over your brother's day, the day of his misfortune. Yes, do not boast in the day of their distress. Obadiah 1:12. And we don't gloat in their suffering because godly love does not rejoice in wrongdoing. As children of God, our goal is to express godly love to everyone in our lives. This is more difficult for some than it is for others. But we all ask the same question when faced with the command to do so. How? How do I express the love that I feel for others? And as Paul lays out this structure of godly love in 1 Corinthians 13, we must first follow this blueprint and be the complete antithesis of these negative characteristics. We must also realize that these words serve as a great gauge to help us keep check of our actions. If at any point we realize or we find ourselves at some stage of this pyramid, we will know what to change so that the people in our lives will know that we love them. And this morning, the source of that love, the God of heaven and the God of earth, stands with his arms wide open. Maybe you need to respond to put on Christ in baptism. Experience that love maybe for the first time. Or maybe you need to experience that godly love through the prayers of your family here. Whatever your need may be, the invitation stands open while together we stand and sing.